I am Platt on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Describing anything is often made easier by taking the time to describe what something is not. For example, I get dubbed a journalist elsewhere on the internet. I don't like that because I've never trained as a journalist, and it would be unfair to those who have. But the program does have an air of that, and perhaps it's from inspiration more than anything else. I grew up consuming all sorts of media and continue to do so. I like the news, and the chance to talk about it on this program is one of the perks. This is an avocation, and I can do pretty much whatever it is I'm interested in terms of the topics and the sort of guests on here. It's also a great chance to talk about the media, journalism, and how it's all put together. As I've said with other guests in recent weeks, there isn't a robust culture of criticism in Canada, and I think we're the poorer for it. Why is that? And what would criticism mean for the press? Better journalists, perhaps? I'm joined now by Ross Howard. He's a veteran journalist, mainly in print, but he worked in television for a spell before moving into the world of academia, where he teaches journalism at Langara College here in Vancouver. He was a national correspondent for the Globe and Mail, where he also served in the Ottawa Bureau as a parliamentary correspondent. He worked at the Toronto Star, too, and the Toronto Telegram. He's won numerous awards, including two Websters, one for writing and one for television. He often contributes to the Canadian Journalism Project at j-source.ca. We'll talk about the state of journalism in these parts, focusing on the print business. Are newspapers going to survive? How can they be profitable again, as they seemingly can't? Please welcome to the Platt Online program in studio, as it were, Ross Howard. Mr. Howard, good morning.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for coming in to do this. I appreciate it.
Should be fun.
When you look at the state of newspapers today, it's awfully different than it was, say, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 25 years ago, right?
Much more, I'd say, 10 or 15 years, yeah.
And when you talk to publishers, newspaper publishers, they tend to cite declining ad revenue, declining subscriptions. Is that really what the problem is?
It's the source of the problem for the publishers. Publishers' primary responsibility is to maintain the profitability for the owners. So what they are being driven to doing to journalism then becomes our problem. Their problem is they're not making enough money. Our problem is that they're trying to make money by cutting the quality of the journalism that we do get from their products. And as a result, we are all suffering in this country increasingly from a corporately concentrated and incredibly slimmed down media institution in the country. And if it gets much worse, we'll begin to see a kind of imperiled democracy.
Do you find that readers are interested in quality journalism?
Quality journalism will gather readers. This applies not only to print, but to the other broadcast media too. That's the whole name of the game, is to be a terrific storyteller. So compelling that people will want to stop, pick up the newspaper, and wow, I didn't know that before. Ah, this is what it means. Or to say, whoa, turn on the television tonight because I really like the way they explain these things that are happening around and tell me what really matters to me and my community and what I need to know to profit and thrive in this community. So if you don't have quality journalism, you run the risk of increasingly getting entertainment style diversions. Because it's the easiest thing to produce. And pretty soon you have a less and less well-informed citizenry.
And so when you see citizens cynical, say, about their politicians, or apathetic about issues, voter turnout declining, is there a line that can be drawn to, say, how the media covers people's lives and what's important to them, or what should be important to them?
The connection may not be direct, but I think it's implicit. That the way the media treats, for instance, politics and the importance of it and the players will influence what the public in turn thinks and whether it's willing to be engaged or not. I think there's no doubt about it that, for instance, the conduct of the mayor of Toronto has substantially further demeaned public respect for elected politicians. It's changed what some people will say is a tolerable standard. But this has been going on for a considerable period of time. Partly, it reflects perhaps a lower quality of people who are getting into politics. And it includes the media perhaps being a little more given to covering the tawdry side all the time. Uh-huh. because it's easy. It's very easy to just do another slightly icky story about Rob Ford's latest behavior. But there are other things that are happening around that behavior that really matter to Toronto. Is it true, as he says, that he has produced the best financial administration in 100 years? Has he accomplished all these things, or is he politicking? Somebody needs to hold him to account. So don't just write about his occasional drunken stupors, but also ask the questions. Is the mayor correct? Is he accurate when he says he's run the best administration ever?
So when you see a pack of journalists chasing him down a hallway or into an elevator, people shouting questions at him about his behavior, do you think that the media is acting, say, in the public interest, in that that's what the public is interested in, rather than, say, public policy or the ideology of the Fords?
I think the public can be very easily made to be interested in the behavior of the Fords. It's titillating. It's a little tawdry. There's a degree of...
It's a great story, right?
It's bringing down the high and the mighty. Yeah. And Ford also, to some people in some places, stands for a particular political ideology. So, yeah, you can cover it that way, but the whole pack doesn't need to continuously chase Rob Ford. Why are all those journalists all chasing Rob Ford into an elevator to ask him the same question over and over again? Because they simply want to be there and make sure they get the same inane remark or response. But that's fine. Somebody's also got to tomorrow go upstairs to the city clerk's office and pore through the documents to find out if what the mayor has been saying is matched by the public record.
And have you found, like, statistics say that the Toronto Star's readership has increased because of the Rob Ford story? I know they've been at the fore of it. You know, they saw the video first. Well, not first, but they saw, you know, they're one of the first people in this country to see the video. Mm-hmm. Is the reason why they're covering it as they are, is that because it means eyeballs to the paper, eyeballs to the website?
It probably means eyeballs in the immediate 24 hours after these kind of events become public, either through their breaking the news or somebody else, and the Star has a huge staff and it can cover these things more intensively. But I don't think that it's driving the Toronto Star's circulation up significantly. I think you could argue that to some extent they are fulfilling, however, their public responsibility to hold politicians' feet to the fire, to hold this man to account for his behavior. That doesn't drive the circulation up on a daily basis, except for occasional incidents, though. It doesn't do that kind of thing.
We seem to be dwelling on the Rob Ford story, but I just thought of something that I've mentioned to you and I've mentioned to previous guests. What a big fan I am of Jesse Brown's podcast, Canada Land, which his attempt to bring media criticism to this country. Mm-hmm. On his first episode back in October, he had Michael Enright on, who he worked for years at CBC Radio. And he mentioned that people in the media knew about Rob Ford smoking crack, say, a year before this video came out. And he's wondering why. And I don't know how much you know about the Rob Ford story being out here, but according to Jesse Brown, this video had existed for a while, yet the Canadian media were afraid to touch it, and that it took Gawker in New York to post it on its website before the media started covering it here. Is it
possible?
Yeah.
Could it be true? Unfortunately, it could be true. It shouldn't be true anymore today because, in fact, the Supreme Court has more than once produced rulings which have allowed clearly for the media to take a more aggressive stance than they used to be able to do.
So why isn't the media in this country then doing that?
Well, I think ultimately they have been doing it. I mean, it is the Toronto Star which had the courage to say, we don't have it in our hand, but we have two extraordinarily talented, capable, reliable sources, our own reporters, who say they've seen this kind of thing. And it became a question of, do you believe trained professionals, the two journalists, or do you believe the elected politician, that the video doesn't exist, or they said it does exist? Well, it was an enormous vindication for professional journalism that they were right. He was wrong. He denied it, and in fact, he was wrong. That kind of thing is happening a little more, and certainly we encourage journalists, I know at Langarrett, to understand what their legal limits are, but if they can prove that it's in the public interest, and they believe they have met all the professional standards, then definitely print it, broadcast it.
So in terms of the Rob Ford story, you're comfortable saying that the media in this country has done as good a job covering it? Or was there a sort of a lapse in terms of...
No, I don't know that people knew for sure and felt secure in reporting that the mayor had been videotaped smoking crack a year before it came public. I don't know that.
Or that he had had, like, say, issues with drugs.
Well, to give the Toronto Star credit, they had reported incidents where he had appeared in public and seemed to be intoxicated. They didn't make those front page every time, but, yeah, they had been covering it.
And I think the Globe and Mail had a lengthy
eventually,
piece.
Eventually, the Globe came on board.
In terms of the state of the media today, and whenever something breaks in this town with regards to an ethical issue or something like that, you're always called upon to appear on programs and start to talk about it.
Sometimes.
The most recent one, I guess, was the Carol Todd incident. This was, I guess, the morning after the Webster Awards.
Right.
Where the Vancouver Sun took home the major prize for reporting because of its coverage of the Amanda Todd suicide. And so, to recap, briefly, Carol Todd goes on to the Huffington Post the next day, posting a blog post where it's revealed that, I don't know, how do I couch this, that the reporting was...
Carol Todd indicated and said in her column that she was enormously grateful to the Vancouver Sun reporters for the kindness and service they paid to her in helping her learn how to deal with the media. The blog was fairly descriptive, talked about what seemed to any normal reader to indicate that the Sun team had in fact been fending off other media, had been giving her media advice, and that it had, to my own view, crossed the line between simply being a empathetic but disengaged observer and had become a participant in Carol Todd's own presentation of her points of view.
And I think I heard you on the Stephen Quinn program on CBC saying that this was a sad day for journalism.
If it were true, as Carol Todd herself said it was so.
So since then, the blog post was removed. A week or so later, Harold Monroe, the editor of the Vancouver Sun, came out saying that her account of it on the Huffington Post was not entirely accurate. Do you take him at his word?
I think I'd like to have heard more words. He didn't say how it was inaccurate. He basically said, trust us. And I think that this is the kind of hubris that the mainstream media too often suffers. You cannot just simply say, trust us anymore, because too many people have seen too many mistakes and flaws in the media behavior in the past, and there's a cynicism towards mainstream media that's at least partially deserved. So he, I think, owed it to his media consumers to be more forthcoming in describing and making sure everyone understood that his word could be trusted, and we didn't get that from him. It also came only several days after this controversy had been thoroughly discussed by a number of other journalist participants and instructors and commentators around the country, so that they sort of weighed in at the end and said, don't bother us with this, go away. I don't think it was a sufficient explanation to reassure the public.
And I guess this speaks to the lack of media criticism in this country. We don't have the culture, the critical culture that they say that they have, say, in the United States.
True, although it's worth noting that that incident that we're discussing now was fairly well discussed on a site the journalists tend to access,
the jsource.ca. Yeah.
There wasn't much discussion of it, however, in the mainstream media.
And why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's very similar to one of your previous guests' explanation. The mainstream media in Canada tends to suffer from both too much pride, and they don't want to be embarrassed by revealing how the sausage is made sometimes. There's only a handful of owners of media in this whole country, so it doesn't take very many people to sort of implicitly feel, no, let's all agree we aren't going to criticize ourselves. We're not going to reveal our warts and our failures. And so, compared to the United States, where media criticism is much healthier, or the UK, where it's gone beyond healthy and now become kind of a festering, unfortunate affair, we just don't have media willing to talk about other media, let alone themselves. We only have, what, two papers in the country who have staffers who are responsible for discussing the media behavior. only two in the whole country out of about 100 dailies, plus the ombudsman at the CBC.
So, what, I mean, there's obviously, I mean, I, as a media consumer, I can see that if there was a healthy culture of criticism, the sort of peek behind the curtain, if you will, as to how the news is made, it would make for better news. Do you think the news is suffering because there is this hubris, as you said earlier?
Oh, I think so. There's no doubt that if, for example, the editor of the Vancouver Sun had been more forthcoming in his responses to the criticisms of the Carol Todd coverage, it's possible that more people would have read it and said, "Ah, now I understand exactly why the Sun says what they do." They did have a series of checks and balances. They did discuss this with the reporter, and in fact, notwithstanding what Ms. Todd wrote, it's pretty clear the Sun did very carefully consider and avoid becoming a party to conflict of interest. He didn't go through that, however. And those were the questions that were being raised on JSource, to which the Sun didn't answer. So as a result, the public remains skeptical towards the integrity, the credibility, the ethics of the media.
And so how do we get a better media then?
Literally, consumers need to
give a damn.
Speak up. They need to need to revolt. It's their media. It's not the owner's media. Ultimately, mainstream media only survives by the degree to which people will consume it, and therefore theoretically buy the products that are advertised on it. The media is very vulnerable to and very sensitive to public criticism, and it doesn't get that much. I mean, the people who comment on the blogs after CBC posts something, I mean, it's very often the same people who very quickly diverge into flame wars. But if everyone else who consumes daily media and is disappointed in the information they get, it's inadequate or misleading or inaccurate, if everyone else complained more often, pretty quickly, editors and managers would begin to say, "Oh my gosh, is the word getting out around town that we're not reliable?" Because ultimately, reliability and integrity are the only things to this day that works for the mainstream media, unless you want to just become an entertainment medium.
The other thing that I found interesting in looking at the news in the last couple of weeks, some figures came out as to digital subscriptions. The Globe and Mail and the National Post, I guess, released some figures as to how many people subscribe to them online, I guess, digitally. The numbers, I think one paper had it about 100,000. It's in around that neighborhood, right? 100,000 each for the Globe and each for the National Post. That doesn't seem like very much, or is it?
It's not that much, but it's just the beginning.
I see.
Remember, until 2 years ago in this country, almost nobody had a firewall or a pay-for-view kind of policy. We've gone through 10 to 15 years of when the mainstream media has been giving away its most valuable product, reliable information. It's been giving it away. It's been posting it online. All of the print and television and many of the radio stations across this country all went down the same rather naive route of giving away the only thing that they're worth pursuing, which is reliable information. And so it's now created almost a full generation, a 10-year period of consumers, media consumers, who think it's all free. Of course, it's not. Information costs a lot of money to get if you want to be able to believe it. And so reliable information is expensive. You got to find a way to pay for it. Clearly, advertisers aren't going to support the traditional models anymore. So there are only a couple of alternatives, and one of them is, if you want to have a reliable source, and that's what I believe will ultimately save the mainstream media, is that even the people, the kids who now say that, you know, they can't be bothered paying for it, and they don't want to watch the news, they don't care. Well, when they get past this delayed onset of maturity, somewhere around the age of 30, 35, it used to be 28, and before that it was 21, apparently. Well, somewhere around the delayed onset of maturity, they've suddenly got all sorts of pressures. They've got a partner, and they've got a mortgage, and they've got kids, and they've got a car payment to keep, and they have to be to work on time. And so they need to be able, in the morning, to turn on a source that quite correctly says, yes, it's safe to cross the Oak Street Bridge because it's still in working order today, and by the way, that's not a good place to invest your money today, and don't buy product X or Y because the kids' toys are still coated with lead or there's melamine in the cat food. They don't have time to go through 30 blogs. They don't have time to go to 30 websites. They're not even going to troll through all the comments in the Huffington Post to get this daily agenda. They need a reliable source, one or two or three of them at best. That's where the mainstream media is going to survive. It's reliability, it's the trust that they set out a fairly decent agenda of things you need to know to carry out the rest of your life today.
Did you find that, that people will then get a subscription to one of the papers, or digitally or otherwise, or that they'll want to pay for this? Because as you said, the last 10 years or so, people have been hesitant to pay because they've expected it for free.
It's going to take another probably 5 to 10 years for this transition to be accomplished, during which time the papers will, in particular, but also broadcast, they will be scrambling because they're not going to get everybody to subscribe, and they're afraid everyone else is just going to disappear to only getting their news through Yahoo or Google or something like Facebook.
Yeah.
But when these people, as I say, get a little older and they don't have the time to sit down every morning and work through all the Facebook bits of gossip to figure out what's really important, is anybody gossiping about the Oak Street Bridge today? I don't know. Then I think you're going to find a move to being willing to pay for essential information, information that's reliable.
But 5, 10 years down the road, this town may lose one of its local papers.
That's entirely possible. There will be a retrenchment. There will no doubt be cost-cutting because the owners aren't interested in operating entirely in the public service. They want to make a profit. So sure, it's possible that something negative like that will happen first. But I think that in 5 to 10 years, you're going to find going online and being billed 30 cents for 30 minutes. Scan everything you see in the Vancouver Sun Province or whatever the online site is going to be called. I think that's what people will be used to doing.
And so one of the things that we hear a lot of from journalists is that newsrooms in the city and elsewhere, they seem to be cutting costs, and there's not enough bodies in the newsrooms nowadays than there were, say, 20, 30 years ago. The trends are that they're hiring cheaper journalists, trying to run newsrooms on the cheap and the sort. Do you find that continuing to be a trend? And if it is going to be a trend, because I suspect I know what your answer is going to be, how then do these publications survive, essentially?
Well, there will still be a public hunger for reliable sources, and it may take 5 years for the surviving ones to become fixed in the public mind as the right place to go for reliable information and for a decent agenda for your day. I think that that's what's going to happen over time, but there will be victims who fall along the way. There will be probably some retrenchment here in Vancouver. It's sort of always underway in this town anyway.
I'm 31. I'm about to be 32. I'm assuming that I'm around the age of some of the reporters that I read in the papers in this town.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not old enough to remember what a Socred is. So, did you find that newsrooms in this city, elsewhere, have this lack of, say, institutional memory?
Absolutely. It's much more expensive to keep a 55-year-old journalist on staff who's built up seniority and therefore higher pay, and who doesn't have the energy to rush out and cover fire trucks and ambulances on a regular basis, but wants to spend 3 to 5 days or even longer researching something that's got a lot of carefully assembled data. So sure, that reporter who wants to take that time and produce this intensive kind of reporting is costing you a lot of money. Why don't you simply send out 3 graduates who just joined the business and will work for much lower pay, and just have them cover car crashes? But at some point, if you just cover car crashes, the public is going to turn away to an alternative source. And it may be that it's a place that does have some of those gray-haired, institutional, memorized kind of people, or memorialized kind of people. We desperately need them. We need context. We need to know if what's being said today is totally contradictory to what was said by a politician or by a public official only 6 weeks, let alone 6 years ago. That's what? One of those essential public roles that the media plays. I mean, it is this institutionalized watchdog. It's part of the way our democracy works. And I know from my experience working abroad in countries which don't have the rule of law and have enormously constrained or repressed media, that we rely enormously on the roles of the media, as a bulwark of democracy, and we don't realize how significant it is in this country. But take it away, and you're looking at countries like Somalia or in Kyrgyzstan very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So do you remain hopeful then?
I do.
Yeah.
I hate to see what is being done to the practice of journalism right now, the cheapening of it, the dumbing down, both what's being done to the consumer and what's being done to the journalists. I really do. And I do find that the corporate mentality seems to be entirely obsessed with the profit motive rather than the public service. But journalism is, or the news media, is an exception to the normal corporate kind of animal in Canada and in almost all Western democracies. It's a very unique privately owned public service. And in Canada, we have the exception of the CBC, as most Western countries outside of the United States do, by the way. Almost everyone else has a public service broadcaster and often publicly subsidized print media.
So why don't owners realize that then? I mean, because at some point an owner is going to realize that this is not profitable, so let's just shut down a bunch of papers, and then we're the poorer for it, like the paper in Kamloops closing. That's not going to come back, even though the public wants it to come back.
But the owners don't care as much about what the public wants. They have shareholders that they're primarily responsible to or feel they should be responsible to. Remember, we got into this crisis in the media, at least partially, in the mainstream media, because a lot of corporate owners were so busy accumulating other assets and stripping, and it's still happening in the mainstream, stripping assets out of the news business to pay for other acquisitions. I mean, the Vancouver Sun and the Vancouver Province, until very recently, if not today, were still making money. But that money was then being shipped off to Toronto, so to speak, to pay for those astounding debts that the previous owners had run up in buying television production facilities in Montreal. Those were people who were pursuing a corporate agenda, and that's fine, that's what they were hired and set to do, and the shareholders expected it of them. But they were doing it with what is a very unique institution, a public service, that nonetheless is privately owned. That's the mainstream media.
So then how does corporate culture change in that regard? Do you think that the owners that own the major newspapers, the television stations in this country, do you think they'll have a change of heart, say?
Substantially, unless the public pushes them to it, and unless the political system pushes them to it. We had much more powerful institutions, regulators, the CRTC, for example, in this country, but over the period beginning with the Liberals, certainly by the Trudeau era, but more so after that, and then the Conservatives since, they have watered down the CRTC as a regulator. They have shown no enthusiasm for supporting a free and independent media. So as a result, we now have people who are almost entirely focused on the profit obsession and not on the public service side among the owners.
So the media consumer does have a part to play in this. They can't just assume that it's going to be free. They do have to pick up the phone.
They have to pick up the phone, and they have to probably pick up the online subscription and pay for it if they want to be well informed.
Yeah. In terms of, I've had a lot of people on this program in the last 10 years, I guess, talking about the media, like people like Rafe Mayer and Jim Taylor. They like to talk about the media that once was, and that it was better, say, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago. It's not enough to lament the past, that we do have to get on with it and do something about it, I guess, right, as consumers. And I think journalists themselves, they have a role
absolutely
to play in their future, if you will.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with you that lamenting the past by itself isn't going to do anything. And there'll be fewer and fewer people who even understand the lament anyway.
Yeah.
No, you're going to have to find ways to defend what's really important about having a reliable ethical media. And how do you make that clear to the public? And that falls, unfortunately, back on the same people. The people who both own the media and the people who work in the media. Journalists should... Here's a should. They should stop whining and start speaking up in defending their institution and disciplining themselves to do better journalism. And I have never had to do this, but they're going to have to make some tough decisions. You want to be part of this particularly almost sacred profession called journalism. You may have to be willing to walk away from a job someday because you're being ordered to do something by a senior editor or a manager, which runs totally contradictory to the public interest.
This is just a fascinating time, but I appreciate you coming in because it's taught me a little bit about what's going on and I guess the role that we all have to play if we want journalism to survive, because I think that's at the end of the day, that's everyone's goal, right?
I think you're quite correct that way, that the media is as much a public responsibility as a journalist's or professional journalist's responsibility too.
Yeah, I appreciate you coming in to do this. It's a pleasure to meet you.
It's my pleasure. Enjoyed your questions.
Ross Howard is an instructor in the Department of Journalism at Langara College. He joined me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Ponto.